Blog Talk Radio.
Healing rain is coming down. It's coming nearer to this old town. The rich and poor, and strong, it's bringing mercy, it won't be long, it won't be long. Healing rain is coming down, it's coming closer to the lost and found. Tears of joy, tears of shame, a wash forever in Jesus' name. The healing rain, it comes with fire, so let it fall and take us higher. The healing rain.
What a welcome, everyone in Canada and all over the internet, to The Cross in the Desert, as we spend the day speaking hope and freedom to Iran. My name is Randy Noble. So very happy to join you after a long month. It's been a long time, and I miss my Canadian friends. I miss my Canadian audience. It is such a pleasure to be with you today. We have an incredible program. I love talking about Iran. I love speaking hope and freedom to my friends. And we have Canada's own Shadi Pava as my guest today. Shadi Pava is a human rights activist who lives right in Ottawa. She lives right where you're at in Canada, a tremendous expert on the penal code, the justice code in Iran. She is going to talk about the deplorable human rights violations that my Iranian friends suffer with. She is an amazing lady, and we're going to join her for a full hour. She has a wealth of information. She works very, very hard at translating letters and documents from prisoners, and she spends her life dedicated to the hope and freedom of her Iranian friends and those who are suffering under this dictatorship. You do not want to miss this program today. It is a wealth of information. When I have questions about what's going on in the Islamic Republic, Shadi is my first choice. She knows the subject well. She lived there. And she has been through a painful, painful time in her life. She's going to talk a little bit about that. I don't want to say a whole lot about that because that's for a little later time in the next 25 minutes. We'll be talking to her. And speaking of Iran, we have some very, very updated developments in the case of Saeed Abedini. Saeed Abedini, as you know, is the American Christian pastor who's been the international focus, national and international focus, as an American-Iranian pastor in Evin prison. He has spent more than 1 year in that prison because of his Christian faith. And it is deplorable. Anyone should be discriminated for what they believe, but Iran chooses to do this. They play international politics with the world, with their prisoners. And Shadi will tell us an awful lot about that today. The latest developments in Pastor Saeed's case. Well, just recently, he was transferred out of Evin prison into another prison. And I just want to talk about this a little bit because it's very important. It's the Rajail Shahar prison. It is a prison that Iranians put prisoners in who they want to disappear. And as you know, Saeed has been in the spotlight for a very long time. The American Center for Law and Justice has worked very hard with his wife, Nagma, with petitions, speaking events, prayer vigils. And then just a month or so ago, President Obama actually talked with President Rouhani about the Americans in Iran, particularly Saeed, and told Rouhani he called for his release. It took over a year for our president to speak up in behalf of one of the citizens of this country, but he did it. Give him credit for that. And since then, there has been many, many developments now. With Saeed in the spotlight, they have moved him into this dangerous prison, and we're going to find out all about that from Jordan Seculo right now from the American Center on Law and Justice. He was recently on Fox News. Let's listen to more of the details of Saeed's grave situation right now on The Cross in the Desert. Here's Jordan Seculo.
The phone calls are cut off now. The kids won't even be able to hear their dad's voice. It just seems very devastating that not until they're teenagers, they're, you know, and toddlers right now, will they ever hear their dad's voice or see him.
That is the wife of Iranian-American pastor Saeed Abedini from earlier this year, talking about the family's ordeal, and now there are new concerns for the family. After word her husband is being moved to a different jail, Jordan Seculo, executive director of the American Center for Law and Justice, he also represents the Abedini family. And Jordan, good day to you.
Thanks, Bill.
Why would a different jail be so difficult for him?
Well, this jail, Raja Shar, is a murderer's jail. It's a violent criminal's jail. Evin Prison, as horrible and notorious as it is, it's a political prison. It's got a lot of attention on it, and so it's high profile. This prison is further outside of Tehran, so harder for families to visit. In fact, Saeed's family was told at this time, though they're supposed to get once every other week visits, he's not allowed any visitors, and he's under quarantine, and he's in Ward 9, which is the murderer's ward, so he's sharing a 10-by-10 cell with five people who have been convicted of violent crimes. These are people that are basically on death row. So unlike being in a prison that's horrendous and you may face torture, you're now imprisoned with people who are just as violent as maybe those prison guards.
Jordan,
and so that's why the concern is so high.
Why would this – apparently a family member went to the jail and they were told that he was moved.
Why would
he be moved?
This is what we're very concerned about. It's not that the United States government, they're very deeply troubled. The State Department, I will tell you, Bill, and for everyone watching, their tone was very serious yesterday when they heard about this news because they've been reaching out. The president made that phone call to the president of Iran and mentioned Saeed. We believe it's more likely that this is an internal battle. As Fox News reported yesterday, you showed the protest, the Death to America Day in Iran. There are elements within the Iranian regime that are trying to undermine any change in relationship or any negotiations with the United States and Iran, primarily the Revolutionary Guards Corps. They would have the power to transfer Saeed out of Evin into Raja Shar, and if he were to be killed, and this is a place, as a Dutch diplomat said, where prisoners go to disappear, where it's very likely and common for murders to occur and people to be executed and the state to blame it on other prisoners, to undermine, again, U.S., any kind of growing U.S. relationship.
Two quick things, Jordan. Does the family in Iran have any contact with him now, and how is his health? And I need a quick answer on that.
Sure. Really quickly, his health was getting better. And second, the family does not know at this time when they'll next be able to see Saeed. They were told, as of right now, he's not allowed visitors. He's under quarantine.
Wow. Jordan, thank you. Keep us updated, okay?
Thank you, Bill.
Jordan,
thanks for covering.
Jordan Seculo watching Abedini's story as it continues in Tehran. Thank you, Jordan.
This drama continues to unfold. And when I think about what's happening, the many, many developments that are going on, I think about my dear friend Nagma, Saeed's wife, and just the incredible fortitude and the courage that she continues to demonstrate in the face of real evil. And I want to read to you her status this week. I want you to know a little bit about the heart of Nagma and what it's like to go through this. It's so easy for me to sit here in my safe house, as you will, and to read this. It's one thing to do that. It's another to experience that. I think we all understand that. But I want to read from Nagma this week. I want you to hear her heart about what's going on. She says, I want to share something personal with you. Yesterday, when I heard Saeed's news of being transferred to Raja al-Shahar prison, I fell to my knees crying uncontrollably. Feeling so weak and worn, I felt that this was the blow that I couldn't recover from. I didn't have the strength to stand up or speak a word. The kids immediately came to my mind, referring to Jacob and Rebecca, her two children. Their innocent faces as they waited for Daddy's return. Saeed's face raced before my eyes. Defenseless in the hands of radicals, I knew I had to get back up again and fight for his life. Relying on my faith in Jesus Christ and the prayers and support of all of you surrounding me, I am up by his grace. Knowing that more now than ever, we have to raise our voices together. We have to pray. We have to take action against this injustice. I ask you to join me in signing this petition and asking others to do so also. Thank you for your support in prayer and fasting. Just yesterday, NGMA concluded a 3-day prayer and fast for God to intervene in her husband's difficult grave situation, and many of our Facebook friends also joined her in this really important endeavor. She's referring to a petition that has gained a lot of signatures. Thankfully, this petition website is gaining lots of signatures. Today is very important. Today, Thursday, November 7th, there are diplomatic talks, as we speak, going on, I believe it's in Geneva, going on between the U.S. and Iran. And this petition, I hope, will be talked about there. And you want to go to Be Heard Project, BeHeardProject.com. Go to the BeHeardProject.com. You will see some instructions on scrolling down. You'll see a picture of Saeed's face. Please sign this petition. There are talks going on today. And here is the real difficult struggle with this story. Not just the emotional struggle, but to keep it before the eyes of the media. That is so important, and that is a very big challenge to do. And as I speak to you right now about what's going on with diplomatic talks between Iran and the U.S., I want to also make you aware that here in the United States, there has been a bipartisan Senate support for the release of Saeed. And I'm so thankful for Senator Rand Brand Paul, who has spoken out against the war on Christianity. I don't know if you've listened to this. He's talking about how we're funding countries that are hostile to Christians, Syria, Egypt. He goes down the list on the war on Christianity. And I love this man's passion and his conviction. Some of you, I'm sure, may think, well, it's all about politics. I don't see that. I see a real compassion and a love for the truth in Senator Rand Paul. And so what has happened is that he has pushed his influence and his weight in the Senate and has worked with other senators, Jim Risch, Republican from Idaho, Mike Crapo, and Patrick Leahy, the Democrat from Vermont. There has been bipartisan support for the release of Saeed Abedini. And so this resolution calls of Iran to immediately release Saeed Abedini and all other individuals detained on account of their religious beliefs. In recent weeks, hopes have been high that Iran was preparing to do the right thing and release Pastor Saeed and other prisoners of conscience as part of a good faith showing under the newly elected President Hassan Rouhani. This is what the ACLJ has been saying. But as we talk with Shadi today, we are going to find out really what Rouhani is all about. We're going to find out the goals, the manipulations, and the politics of Iran. Because as this program is airing now, Iran continues to execute political prisoners. They have been on a rampage of executions since Rouhani's inauguration. So much for moderation. So much for good faith when this man stands by and watches, and he is part of this. Make no mistake. So we have this one side of Rouhani smiling to the media. Look at me, the Mr. Moderate. And the other side of Rouhani, who agrees with the Supreme Leader, kill them, execute them. When will we learn that mullahs, politicians, are liars, they're manipulators, and they do this for their own political gain? We're going to find out more today. I don't want to go into all of the details. Shadi is going to enlighten you about what is the ultimate goal of the Iranian machine. They're a culture of death. They're a culture of destruction. And they're suddenly having this metamorphosis, this face change of all of a sudden, we want to be moderate. We want to work with you. We want to negotiate with you. Jesus said, beware of the wolves in sheep's clothing. Apropos, when it comes to the Islamic regime, they are wolves in sheep's clothing. This is what we're dealing with here, and it's serious. The Americans in Iran must be immediately released. And the Senate has said in this bipartisan bill, they're recognizing that freedom of religious belief and practice is a universal human right and a fundamental freedom of every individual, regardless of race, sex, country, creed, and a fundamental freedom, and should never be arbitrarily abridged by any government, recognizing the universal right to believe and to worship as you see fit. Number two, they recognize that governments have a responsibility to protect that fundamental right of their citizens. So this government is not doing any protection. They're doing more of killing. And the third part of this resolution calls on the government of Iran to immediately, no conditions, no bargaining, to immediately release Saeed Abedini and all other individuals detained on account of their religious beliefs. I am so thankful for this bipartisan bill in the Senate. It is something that is wonderful to see bipartisans. With all that is happening on my side of the fence with Obamacare, with the continued infringement of the rights of Americans to have their own health care as they see fit and not be told by the government what they will have as health care. When I see that oppression of freedom, and then I see this bipartisan bill, I'm hopeful. I'm hopeful that there is a glimmer of light and hope at the end of the tunnel. Very thankful for Senator Rand Paul and those involved with this legislation for Saeed. Now, I want to also mention to you something that really caught my attention today. I was just preparing for the show. It's a wonderful thing. John Baird, the foreign, it's amazing. He's Canadian, and I'm so thankful for a person like John Baird standing up for an oppressed people. And I want you to hear what he has to say. Canada's own John Baird, the foreign minister. Earlier this year, John writes, Iran elected a new president, Hassan Rouhani, whose manner, style, and language stand in stark contrast to the posturing and belligerent behavior of his predecessor, Mahmoud Ahmadinejad. Okay? The conciliatory tone and approach of the new president is welcome, especially with regard to Iran's nuclear diplomacy, and we were relieved to hear of Iran's release of a small number of political prisoners. All of us have felt despair over the Iranian regime's baneful influence abroad and its ruthless oppression of its own people, and want to believe now that this country is genuinely committed to positive change at home and in its foreign relations. But we do not have the luxury of being naive, writes John, nor do the Iranian people who have suffered for far too long. Standing in front of cameras and tweeting about change, that's easy to do, John writes. The hard part is following through, making difficult decisions, and undertaking meaningful change. We must judge the Iranian government by its deeds, not its words. President Rouhani marks his first 100 days in office. This past Tuesday was the mark of the 100 days. And by any measure, these deeds have fallen short. Through human rights monitoring and reporting, efforts by the UN Security General and the UN Special Rapporteur on the situation of human rights in Iran, we know that Iran's human rights record is deeply troubling and that these abuses are continuing. Women continue to face serious discrimination. Iran's ethnic and religious minorities also continue to face disappropriate discrimination, as well as harassment by authorities. More than 100 members of the Baha'i faith alone remained in prison on charges related to practicing and organizing for their religion and advocating for their rights. So in the first 100 days, John correctly points out that Rouhani's promises have fallen far short of his claims. It's one thing to make a claim. It's another thing to back up that claim. I'm so thankful when I look at statements from John Baird, Senator Rand Paul, and again, I think of what Canada has done with the recognition of the 1988 massacre of political prisoners, recognizing a special day in recognition of that horrible atrocity. I see a lot of real good that Canada has done for the rights of Iranians. They have reached out with arms of compassion and love for these people. And I cannot say enough good about Canada, which is where my guest today lives. And just another demonstration that Canada stands with Iran. John Baird stands with Iran. He says standing with an oppressed people, and indeed they are an oppressed people. What I want to do is once again mention to you the website for you to go. You can take a little time. We're on for another hour and a half. Just take your time and go to this website and make your voice heard for Pastor Saeed Abedini. I'm waiting to see. I'm hoping to see some updates on the progress of these diplomatic talks. Now, we've all heard about diplomatic talks. We all know about negotiations to achieve the goal we're committed to. And that goal is to get Saeed out of that very dangerous prison. Yeah, you may say, is there a prison more dangerous than Evin prison? That's the notorious prison you hear about all over the world. The tortures, the rapes, the executions. Can there be another place more dangerous? And yes, there is. It's a place where murderers are put on death row. And this is a place where Iranian people go that the government wants to disappear. It's very serious. NGMA needs our prayers, our support, and our speaking out. Because speaking out is what we do here. Speaking out for the rights of humans, the fundamental rights of humans, to believe what they choose. It's been going on for thousands of years. There has been more attacks on religious freedom than we can even imagine. Of course, there are other countries that do the very thing that Iran does. But my focus is on Iran, because right now in the limelight, we have a situation that requires your praying and speaking out. That's what the cross in the desert is all about. And you may ask, speaking hope and freedom to Iran, is there really, really, really results? And I say, yes, there is. Because our God is an awesome God. He's a God of mercy and compassion. And he works through our praying and our speaking out to accomplish his purposes. To me, that is so humbling, to think that God would choose to work through your praying and your petitioning. And it's not like that the Lord needs us. He is sufficient within himself to accomplish whatever purpose he desires for the human race. But he chooses to use you and me in the process. I think of the book of Daniel, when Daniel prayed Jewish people to return and rebuild the wall. And we see in Daniel chapter 9 how the God of the universe used Daniel's prayer and fasting and intercession for the Jewish people to return. They had been in captivity now for 70 years. Where were the Jewish people in captivity? Think about it. Know your history. Babylon. What is Babylon? Modern Persia. What is modern Persia? Iran. It's amazing how Iran and Israel are so linked in the Bible from thousands of years ago to today. And so we see now on the horizon of history another opportunity that God will use our prayers and our fasting for his glory, crying out to him today, joining hands with John Baird, Rand Paul, and his bipartisan legislation. We're standing strong and speaking out for Saeed's release from Iranian prison. Right now, I want to take you to a song that really sums up what my country, your country needs. It's a spiritual awakening. This is from Chris Tomlin. This is the song called Awakening Here on the Cross in the Desert. Thank you.
when our hearts look in this nation, awakening, Holy Spirit, we desire.
Worship artist Chris Tomlin and Awakening. It's 2:30 in the afternoon here on The Cross in the Desert. I'm your host, Randy Noble, speaking hope and freedom to Iran. I have a very special guest we're going to spend time talking with now for the next hour about Iran, human rights violations, Rouhani, and just a host of other subjects about this dictatorship. Shadi Pave is a human rights activist for Iran who works with many international human rights organizations. She is known for co-translating a key interview which exposed Iran's regime's dubious activities in Canada, which many believe was in part responsible for closing the Iranian embassy in Canada. She has also translated and relayed many documents and letters from prisoners of conscience to the UE Parliament about the grotesque human rights violations in the Islamic Republic of Iran. Ms. Pave has been speaking at universities and cultural centers for many years regarding the Islamic Republic's human rights violations and has written numerous articles about the justice and penal system under the Islamic Republic. I have the pleasure of introducing to you today on The Cross in the Desert, Ms. Shadi Pave. Welcome, Shadi. I'm having a problem unmuting her there. Hello?
Yeah, hang on just one quick sec. We're just having an issue with the telephones. We're going to get her back.
Okay. We have a little issue there, which happens on live blog talk radio. We will get Shadi back, and I think we're going to get her right now, and we're ringing Shadi.
Yes, hello. We got disconnected.
Hello, Shadi.
Hello, Randy. How are you?
I'm doing fine. We had a little glitch with the connection, but you're back live. We're going to have you on and talk about Iran. So very grateful that you've come on today. And I was telling our listeners about your human rights activism from Iran and how that you translate documents and letters from prisoners of conscience. And I'm so grateful that you're here. We've got so much to talk about, and you have a wealth of information. And I want to just thank you for being a spokesperson for a country that is near and dear to my heart, Shadi.
Thank you so much. I appreciate you having me on, and many people are not interested in the fate of Iran unless they're Iranian, so I really quite appreciate this opportunity so everyone can hear what is actually going on, not from politicians, but from actual activists.
That's the important thing, because all of us are tired of the political mumbo-jumbo. We want to get to the heart of the issue. Mm-hmm. You grew up in Iran, Shadi. And as you talked to me one time and told me a little bit about your growing up in Iran, you had a very, very painful experience. Many people don't understand why things happen the way they do in Iran. What happened? Why did we get to this point? And it has everything to do with the Islamic Revolution and the regime change in 1979. Can you please take us back to when you were a child growing up in Iran and describe this happening of the revolution?
Well, I remember it very clearly. I was 13. The revolution was going on probably for a couple of years, so I remember it quite vividly. It's strange how the mind can almost photograph those things that are either really pleasant or really horrible. So I remember all the protests, and I remember it all started, to my memory, when there was this cinema called Cinema Rex that burnt down, and 1,000 people were killed in it, and they were burnt alive. And the resistance to the Shah at the time, which were the Islamic people, the Mujahideen, the Fadai, all these different factions, said that it was the Shah that did it, the Shah's people. And the Shah's people said, we have no clue who did this. So it's pretty well what instigated all the stuff that was boiling over in Iran. And, of course, there were quite a few factions. What I want people to realize is that Ayatollah Khomeini did not create the revolution. Iran wants some kind of a revolution from a soft dictator. Today, we know that the Shah, compared to these people, was a very soft dictator. But at the time, people thought, oh, my God, is he ever a dictator? Which he had human rights issues.
Yes, I was going to interject just a minute,
yes,
just for a second. The movie Argo tries to portray the Shah as this evil, sinister character that the Iranian people wanted to be free of, and that's a misrepresentation of history, is it not, Shadi?
Not quite. There is two sides to that story. The Shah was and his father were amazingly fantastic for making Iran a civilized country. About 100 years ago in Iran, people did not even have last names, showers in their home. My grandmother would speak to me of not having running water, et cetera, et cetera. There were no railroads. There were no trains in Iran at the turn of the century. So they were wonderful for that. And each section of Iran before the Shah's father had its own kind of sort of a person who saw to everything, say like a mayor. It was not a united country. So Shah's father was fantastic, and he brought equality to women. He actually went around and banned women from wearing the hijab and covering up. He was very anti-Islamic in that regard. He did not like religion. He wanted people to have religion if they wanted to, but he did not want it in the government. So that was very good for the Shah and for Iran. The oil, what the Shah did was basically made sure Iran profits from its sales of oil, not just at the time the British were pretty well in control. But the Shah did come up across quite a bit of resistance from leftists at the time being communists, which were the problem of almost everybody in the world, the McCarthy era or what have you. So the Shah did have his notorious secret police called SAVAK that did capture people, execute them, and torture them, and they were quite vile tortures. However, at that time, you had to be politically active or being an armed group before you were actually taken by the Shah. It wasn't religious minorities or such as that.
I've seen some photographs about early Iran, some of the things you are describing, and one of them is about the Shah actually looking at a replica of the Cyrus Cylinder, the famous first Declaration of Human Rights, and he's had a lot to say about human rights in that regard for the people of Iran.
Well, the Shah, though, was no angel. We have to remember that. But what happened was he was no better or worse than any dictator at the time. But now that we look back, given what we know now, he was quite soft compared to what the Islamic regime is doing. Mm-hmm. And it's ironic because Khomeini came and literally robbed and hijacked the Iranian revolution. He told everybody, listen, everybody revolted, whatever factions they were. There were quite a few different resistant groups. They were Islamic groups. They were communist groups. They were secular groups. There were the Kurdish from Kurdistan. There were Azerbaijan. Everybody was revolting against the Shah. And Khomeini came and says, let's all fight together and we'll figure it out. Well, everyone fought together, and then Khomeini came and arrested all of them and executed them in cold blood. So he hijacked the revolution, and that's what people have to realize. And he duped the Iranian people, and Khomeini went on and on. He basically went on and on about the Shah's human rights abuses and how evil he was. But within a couple of weeks of coming into power, Khomeini himself executed every general. One of my uncles was actually one of those. My uncle was one of those people. He executed within the first few months of coming into power. He was a general, and my father was one of them. He killed within because he was a high-ranking officer within a year of coming into power. He has continued today. So the human rights. What Khomeini was talking about, it's mind-boggling because it's unprecedented in basically since the Nazis and the Khmer Rouge and things like that in Cambodia, people haven't cleansed their own population, or Rwanda. I'm probably forgetting a few other countries, or Sudan. Mm-hmm. They're all having to do that, but Iran has never had that. So this is unprecedented for Iran and the world in a way, so... he did hijack it, and I remember the day Khomeini came into Iran. I remember it. He came in. He had been in exile for many, many years, decades, I think. And when they asked him on the plane, how does it feel to return to Iran, his word was hichi, which means in Farsi nothing. He had no feelings coming back to Iran. So that is when we all knew something very sinister is going to happen.
Now, your father, you mentioned, unfortunately, very painful. I'm sorry to even have to talk about this. This must still hurt to this day. But your father was one of the brave, courageous men who said to you at the airport, I remember you sharing this with me, Shadi, there are some things that are worth dying for.
Yes, because he sent us out of the country, and he was quite a few high-ranking officers. This is a very famous coup d'etat called the Noje coup d'etat. Unfortunately, many things about it are in Farsi, but there's quite a few things in English. Quite a few high-ranking officers, secret police agents, intelligence officers got together quite shortly after Khomeini came into power to overthrow him. My father was one of them. And he sent us out of the country to Canada, and he said to me in the airport that there's going to be a coup d'etat, and if it works, I will see you again, but if it doesn't work, I will never see you again, but some things are worth dying for. And I shall never forget that, of course. And, of course, I never saw him again because someone, obviously, they had people who'd infiltrated their group, and he was one of the first people that was, I think, taken. Of course, the details I don't know because it was all so secretive, but he was killed, and after the Noje coup d'etat went through in July and it failed, every single pilot and high-ranking officer within 24 hours faced the firing squad. So no, there was no one after 1980, no one left to fight for from the Shah's side to have a coup d'etat. It was done. And that's how Khomeini kept his power, by killing absolutely everyone, including, when he came into power, children who were 12, 13, 14, anyone who said anything against him, they were killed. And many of my classmates were amongst them.
I'm sitting here reflecting on what you're saying and the bloodshed and the violence in Iran. This continues to be an ongoing thing today. You hear about the lack of human freedom, the lack of human rights. You witnessed this growing up. When did you know within yourself, mm-hmm. knowing what happened to your father, seeing your friends, your classmates treated this way, when did you know that you had to do something about this, that you had to say something and do something to speak up for their hope and freedom?
For me, was the treatment of the Baha'is, because in Iran, you know, if there's political groups and stuff, I was a child, I kind of thought, well, I don't know what's going on with politics. I couldn't grasp that. But when I realized they were literally, because I was helping my father, as soon as, even about a few months or so before Khomeini came in, my father was creating passports and things for the Baha'is and some Jews to get out of Iran, because in a passport would tell you what religion you are. So he would actually have them fixed so that they said they were Muslims, they could get out. So he helped them, and I didn't understand why are they doing this to Baha'is. And we had a neighbor girl, interestingly enough, her name was Melody, and she did her family. I used to play with her, and they were just gone. They were just gone, and I heard that they were taken because they were Baha'is, and I have no idea what happened to them. And I was a child, but then we came to Canada, and I always never forgot that. And I said, as soon as I am old enough and somebody with some kind of education, I'm going to fight and let people know at least what I saw and all that stuff. So I started sort of when I was 23, starting to write about the fate of the Baha'is, but I was threatened quite badly by the regime at the time. That was early 90s, where they were carrying out assassinations abroad, so I actually stopped. It was it really frightened me, so at that time I stopped, but then I came back to, and I was doing it very quietly for many, many years. And I remember telling some MPs and stuff, maybe 15 years ago, about the tortures, et cetera, et cetera, and some of them thought that I had some kind of trauma, and this couldn't possibly be true. It couldn't be possibly true they were executing children. So they didn't believe me and other activists for quite some time. It's only recently that they are believing us, because many things, because of the social media, are coming out, and they're actually filmed. And also a lot of people who are in the within the regime are sick of it, and they're actually helping the activists. Certain prison guards, and all those letters we're getting out, we get phone calls from prisoners. There's quite a few guards who can't take it anymore, and they are actually helping us. And it's very dangerous for them, so we have to remember that they are where they are, but many of them can turn to be with us, so we have to pray for that.
Yes, we do. Well, Shadi, I want to transition a little bit from your experience in early Iran, the regime. I want to bring us right up to date. Before you came on the program today, I was spending a lot of time talking about Saeed Abedini, the American Christian pastor who was in Evan prison but has been transferred to another prison. I'm never going to pronounce this name right. Rajel prison.
Rajel Ishaf,
it's called.
Rajel Ishaf prison.
It's a very dangerous prison.
Indeed.
What I want to talk about a little bit now is everyone, even my friends in Iran that I talk with on Facebook, everyone seems to be rallying behind Rouhani. He is supposed to be the greatest thing since sliced bread. He's the moderate that's going to bring regime change. He's going to bring more freedom for the Internet, for women, for political prisoners. And he's this man of the hour in many, many of my Iranian friends' thinking. Please tell us all about Hassan Rouhani, and is he really moderate, and what is he trying to accomplish?
Hassan Rouhani, there are so many articles written about him that it would be hard for me to actually even start to tell you, but he has been behind quite a few terrorist acts in the past. And there's been quite a few articles that has been written about him. He's one of the founders of the regime. He was very close to Khomeini. What my thing is, never mind his past, because anytime we activists talk about his past, they go, oh, he has changed. Okay, but the problem is it's not about Rouhani. We have to not even bother speaking about Rouhani, because Rouhani is not the head of the country. Speaking of him is not going to accomplish anything. What is important is the head of the country is the supreme leader, Ali Khamenei, who has basically selected Rouhani because he's soft-spoken. He doesn't look like Ahmadinejad. He's not as vile as Ahmadinejad, insulting the Jews, the America, and all that stuff. So he has been chosen in order to fool the West into thinking there is a moderate regime, into thinking that, you know, they want to negotiate. And so what they will do during this time, according to the activists inside Iran and many other intelligence agencies, Iran is 1 month away from having a nuclear bomb. So this is all they're trying to do. Rouhani is as much anti-Israel as anybody. And let's remember, it doesn't matter who he was, and his biography is not important. All we know is that in the last 6 days, they have executed 33 people. Two or three of them were very prominent political prisoners that the activist had campaigned for heavily, and Iran has no shame in doing this. The execution rate since Rouhani's election, not even when he came to power, has dramatically gone up. It's drastic. We used to see about 10 executions a month. We see that now a day, and we're seeing them in groups. The hijab for women, how strict it is. The moral police, they have become much more strict. So things are quite bad. And from the letters I've gotten from prisoners, they have told us, prominent prisoners, saying that please tell the world that since Rouhani got into power, the situation in prison is worse. They are trying to, basically, the only word I can use is exterminate the prisoners, because there has been 3 UN reports by Mr. Ahmad Shahid about the treatment of prisoners in Iran, and they have not allowed him to go into Iran. So we think, it's our best guess, that they're trying to absolutely cleanse all the prisoners so that people can go from the UN and visit Iran, and they say, we don't have any political prisoners because they're not there anymore. They're dead. That's what we think. The cleansing is pretty alarming. Who Rouhani is not at all important. Khamenei, who is the supreme leader, is in power as he has been since, I think, 1989 or so.
When you talked about prisoners and you talked about what they need to tell us and remind us about what's really going on there, I'm thinking of also the juvenile executions that have been continuing on in Iran, the breaking of their own covenants and signatories to certain documents saying that they would not participate in this, and the mass executions, we can go back to 1988. This is a culture of death, Shadi, They will not allow religious viewpoints contrary to Islam. They will not allow you to believe, to speak out. And as I sit here in the United States, I have the freedom to speak to my government, which right now is oppressing us with many, many rights violations.
Yeah.
But we have that freedom. But there in Iran, as you so rightly pointed out, there is no freedom of conscience, no freedom of thought, no freedom of speech. This is a culture of death.
Well, even if right now, the problem we're having right now from the reports we have, there are apparently 300 Christians that are in prison, 100 to 200 Baha'is. The numbers cannot be, we cannot be 100% sure because they are a state secret. They are very careful about that. The one thing the Iranian regime has, they do get embarrassed in front of the world stage because they very desperately want to look like they are a legitimate, fair government. So we have that on our side. However, right now, as far as we know, there are 45 Christians awaiting trial and 43 are in prison. And from what I hear from different prisons, they actually have certain sections that are for political prisoners and for converts. Now, all prisoners are mixed together, whether they are mass murderers, rapists, it doesn't matter, violent, they all are together in order to actually punish punish the political prisoner or the convert. And right now in Iran, if you were born a Christian, it's one thing, but if you convert, they treat you worse than anything that you've imagined in prison. And that's what the problem is. There's a few people, of course, Saeed Abedini, there's Behman Irani, there is Vahid Haqqani. Those three are taken because they were actually preaching the teachings of Christ and having underground churches because you're not allowed to preach. You're not allowed to have a church. And just this month, I believe, or the end of October, there were reports that there were Christians who actually went to a church, Iranian Christians, not converts, and they were given 80 lashes by the order of, I guess, Rouhani and the government. They were given 80 lashes for having wine during communion. This has never happened in history before, so I ask you to decide whether this man is a moderate. And way back under Khatami, which I don't like him either, but he was more, you know, they called him moderate, but there were some religious freedoms allowed, but there is none right now. It's basically extermination right now, and I'm afraid the world is sitting there not realizing what's happening, and they will realize it in 30, 40 years, I don't know, when Steven Spielberg makes a movie about it, and everybody will go make a museum, we will be considered heroes for being the resistance, but it doesn't matter at that time because everybody will be dead. And about Saeed Abedini, I would like to tell you about Rajai Shah prison. It's very important that all your listeners put pressure on President Obama's office to write letters every day or emails every day if you can, because that's the only thing that can do it. The reason they have taken Saeed, and I'm sorry to be the bearer of bad news, but this is my expert opinion, to Rajai Shah prison, which is the worst place, and they take prisoners with injuries or sicknesses. Usually injuries are from torture, and I know that Saeed has got internal bleeding from being beaten up so many times. And they usually send them there because the conditions there are even worse than Evan. And there will be no doctor, there will be no medicine. There usually isn't anyway, but Rajai Shah is particularly bad, and the guards are particularly cruel, and they basically have sent him there to silently die. We call them silent executions because Iran is right now number one in the world for the number of executions per capita. And what they want to do, they're not using nooses or bullets most of the time to kill people. So they're killing the majority of their prisoners, political prisoners anyway, silently. So they make them sick, or if they're already sick, they won't give them their medication.
This is it's deplorable and it's unacceptable. I mentioned to our listeners that we have the BeHeardProject.com where we can go through the ACLJ, who is doing just an incredible job for Saeed. And petition. There are supposedly diplomatic talks going on today in Geneva between Iran and the U.S. And you mentioned Obama. I want you to tell our listeners about the facade that the Iranian regime is trying to do with our president, trying to appear to be negotiable, appear to be moderate. And it seems like our own president is somehow buying this new package, this new moderation that Rouhani is selling.
Well, the problem is we don't really know what President Obama is thinking. And I'm a human rights activist. I am not a political activist, but it's my opinion that President Obama wants to be as politically correct as possible, given the situation that happened in Iraq and Afghanistan. There are no resources to be harsh, and there's also no public support for such action. So he has to be, on the world stage, he has to be very diplomatic, very soft, and he has no other choice. And when the other country is saying, we want to talk, he cannot say anything else. The question is he truly buying into Rouhani, or he's just doing it for the show? I am hoping that he's doing it for show, because you cannot change these people. They have had 34 years of unbelievable, grotesque crimes against humanity. And I do not want to traumatize your listeners, but to give the extent, even their own clergy who turn against them, one of them being Ayatollah Brujerdi, who literally defrocked himself in opposition. So he is one of everyone's heroes. He has said against the regime, he has written many letters to the United Nations and many individuals in government. And he's been tortured the worst. The clergy and the Christians are tortured the worst tortures you can imagine, including poor Ayatollah Brujerdi had to endure having his wife raped before his son, et cetera, et cetera. I'm not going to go. He has been gassed with toxin gas, and as a result, he's got neurological damage. And yet he has said from his prison to us that he will not cooperate with them and he will not take back what he has said, that he's against political Islam, he's against this regime. And so we have to realize that there is opposition within the clergy inside Iran, so no one can do anything. So I do not know what President Obama could do. We don't really know. Nobody knows what could he possibly do. The only thing that is working against Iran, and I'm not saying I'm for or against sanctions, but the only thing that seems to have worked is sanctions, which is there's pros and cons to that. But I just certainly hope that President Obama will think about everything very carefully before he takes any actions or softens his stance on this regime, because they are killing machines. And I am here to tell you, and I can go on record telling you this, the moment Iran gets its atomic bomb, we, the world, will be held hostage, and they will hit Israel. That is their goal. They will do it. But just because that's their motto, that's their ideology, that they'll do it. And then look at North Korea. No one can do anything about North Korea because they have atomic weapons. No one touches their human rights because they have atomic bombs that they threaten us with. So everyone stands back and says, do whatever you want. And North Korea, they have concentration camps, work camps. Iran is, nothing compared to North Korea, and no one can go near them. So you have to think about that.
Yes. Yes, in reference to the nuclear bomb and to the nuclear program they have, the statements that come to mind, Ahmadinejad, we will wipe Israel off the face of the map.
They will.
And Rouhani said that Israel is a wound in the Muslim world, a wound.
Yes.
He called Israel a wound, exact words. No one had to interpret that. He meant what he said. So I agree with you. Their goal is to remove Israel, nuclear.
And we are next. Remember, we're infidels. You have to realize, I don't know how many people in your audience or even how many Muslims have read the Quran cover to cover. I have, twice. And I used to be a Muslim. I'm an ex-Muslim now. So that's all I need to say. The ideology is basically, if a fundamentalist Muslims, moderate Muslims are horrified by this, but ideology is basically spreading jihad and Islam, and the extremists are obviously jihadists. So what do they want? They just want to take over. Sort of I'm very afraid of the incident in Kenya, the mall incident. I don't know if everyone knows the details. I am not going to tell the details because they're horrific. I think only human rights activists have been privy to some of the details that happened in that mall. All I can say to you is that people did not die easily. It was very slow, and they would let the Muslims go, if you were a Muslim, you were safe, and if you weren't, you were tortured to death and died. So this is the kind of thing that extremists are doing in the name of Islam. There is no need to actually analyze Islam or what have you. It doesn't matter. We just have to see the extremists. What are the extremists doing? And what they're trying to do is bomb Israel, get rid of the Jews, and then move west and get rid of our infidels and Christians and everything, everything in between. That's it. That's what they're trying to do.
Well, actually, you're right. The Quran is very clearly, take not Christians and Jews as your friends. Now, the politically correct Islam tries to say that these Muslims that practice this torture, this violence, they're not really true Muslims. But the fruit is very clear. And they believe the Quran says everyone that's not a Muslim needs to be killed for the cause of Allah. And they will try to explain that away.
It's very difficult because Islam is a recognized religion. It's very, very difficult to be put in a position to speak about Islam because you could say anything about Jesus, Moses, Buddha, anything, and no one cares. Everyone understands that the moment you criticize anything about Islam, you're threatened, especially as an activist. So I prefer not to have any talks about Islam itself. I would like to speak about the extremists. Because many Muslims practice Islam, and they are just doing their own thing. They are not going by the exact crazy, crazy word of extremist. The other day, we got an email from a mosque in Toronto, Canada. There is an imam there who was preaching in Canada that women should not even speak without the permission of their husband.
I saw that.
Yeah. So, you know... I don't care if this is coming, where is that coming from? I just do not want to hear it. I don't care if it's religion or a person's mind or it's someone's culture. That should not be spoken, period.
Now, you mentioned Canada. This is very important for us that live in Canada. My good friend Kel, who is the producer behind the scenes, lives in Canada, and of course you do too. Tell us what Canadians are doing, what you're doing to protect your country from the influence of Iranian extremists wanting to have offices there, wanting to have a relationship with Canada. What are you doing as a human rights activist to protect Canada from the influence of Islam and Iranians?
Well, what we're doing as activists, now this is really not our job as an activist. Our job as activists is basically just to bring forth the human rights violations by the regime and expose to the world what this regime is doing basically having a constitution, having rules, but not even respecting its own rules of law. So we're trying to expose this regime by telling the world you can't trust anything that they say, because they say stuff to us all the time. We're not stoning people. We're not killing juveniles, executing them. They are. But what we're doing to protect them, that's not really our job. But if we see someone who is very extremist and stuff, of course, we note them, but it's not really the job of an activist. I think that's left to the authorities. We don't really have a lot to do with that. So we are basically just doing our human rights and dealing with a government in exposing the violations.
Right. I wanted to bring to our listeners' attention, a couple of months ago I had Mariam and Marzea, who wrote Captive in Iran. They spent 259 days in Evin prison, and God mightily used these two women to speak the gospel, to reach out to the political prisoners there in Evin prison. And they talked about just the conditions there that are deplorable. They themselves were not physically tortured, but it was more of a psychological, mental torture. They talked about the interrogations, being sick all of the time. You translate letters and documents from prisoners just so that we have an adequate understanding of what happens in these prisons, what's going on. Can you share with us a little bit about the conditions, for instance, in Evin prison, of what prisoners are experiencing so that our audience understands that?
First of all, Evin prison, of all the prisons, is the most organized. So believe it or not, it's not the worst one compared to all the others. However, the tortures are more systematic, but the worst prison is there is Vakilabad in Mashhad, there is Rajai Shah, which is near Tehran. So there are quite a few prisons that are actually as bad or worse. So what they do, I can tell you what they do in a very small room, perhaps a size of a good-sized bedroom. They might be keeping 60 to 80 prisoners. There is no bed. There is no pillows. Everyone has to sleep, we hear, on the floor in sardine formation. They have to shower with cold water. The criminals, I'm talking the most heinous criminals, are kept together in the general population. The food is atrocious to the point where people have found rats, like rats in their food, not flies or cockroaches, rats and mice. There's no hygiene whatsoever. A lot of people have gum and teeth problems. They have a lot of health issues. There is hardly any fresh air. They're not allowed to go out for very long. Perhaps some prisons, they let them go out for 20 to 30 minutes once or twice a week. They are sent to certain sections. Like if you're a Christian convert, you're kept in the dark completely, and you get only half of the ration of the food that the other prisoners get. These are the conditions. Of course, this comes with the beatings and the torture that are routine. I'm not going to go into the torture because after you hear them, you can't unhear them. And sometimes I've been told, because I read so much of it, that I just blurt them out and people can't get out of their minds for a long time. So the only thing I can say, the best torture, if you're lucky, is being beaten. That's the best one. You're lucky if that's all you get.
It's
so
unreal.
That's the best one. That's your best one. And I remember that when I translate letters, even now, there are sometimes I read certain things that I literally sit at the corner of my apartment sobbing for hours. There is nothing else I can do because I just don't understand the evil that is. These people, that they can do such things, that even if you made a movie or documentary, people will not believe it. So
yes, and I was, you know,
it's one of those things. So the conditions are extremely bad. The food, they're not given enough to eat, or the quality is bad. Even here in prison, everybody has a bathroom in their cell. They don't. For example, they wrote us for something like 1,400 prisoners, there's only about 30 toilets, and some of them are often broken, stuff like that. So they torture them both physically and also in a way that everyday life is extremely difficult for them. Going to the bathroom, having a shower, food, there is absolutely no way of getting medication. They also torture your family, not so much physically, but they don't let you visit. There's no visitation half of the time. And if there is a visitation, they'll make parents who are even elderly wait for 4 to 6 hours, and they're only allowed a five-minute visit, and sometimes not at all. They tell you, okay, you bring the medication for the prisoner, and then they don't give it to the prisoner, et cetera, et cetera. The biggest torture right now is not giving the prisoner medical attention. You torture the prisoner. They have injuries, infections, what have you, and you just leave them there to die from their injuries. And I just want you to imagine, if anyone ever has had a broken rib, what that's like. And you have a broken rib, and they leave you, and they come and beat you every day after that with a broken rib. For a moment, imagine. And that is what's happening to Saeed. So we need to really, really get on our government. I don't know if Obama spoke to Rouhani on the phone about Saeed or Amir Hikmati. I don't know if you know about Amir Hikmati. He's an American born to Iranian parents who was taken in 2011. He was in Iran for the first time, and he has been taken, and just nobody knows why. Of course, they say he's a spy, is this and that, but I don't know if President Obama has even asked for the freedom of these two Americans.
Well, Shadi, when you detail this and you explain exactly what these prisoners are going through, mm-hmm. I feel within myself just an inadequacy, because I do this program, Shadi, to speak hope and freedom. You do the same thing, too, and we have petitions, and we pray, and we cry out. Mm-hmm. And this kind of evil just gets next to us. share with us, how do you deal when you translate these documents, you hear these stories, personally speaking, how do you deal with the emotion? How do you deal with the rage in your soul for the injustices against these people? What is it in your faith that helps you get through this?
Well, for me, it's I truly believe that something out there is helping me. It's bigger than me, because I think I told you on the phone before I even started to get into this human rights activism very publicly and openly, which is quite a dangerous thing to do. I did have a dream of the Virgin Mary, she came to me, and I couldn't see her face. She was more of an outline, and she told me that she's going to, she told me to open my mouth, and she blew this light, a blue light into my mouth, and she said, you need my strength, I'm going to give you my courage, and then I woke up. And I didn't know at the time what I needed courage for, but then a month or so later, there was something we translated, my friend Shabnam Asadullahi, which is a very, very prominent, brave activist, she found this article, and I helped her translate it, and it made national news, and it was not the only reason, but one of the reasons the Iranian embassy was closed in Canada. So that's what I needed the strength for, because with it came a lot of negative things from the Iranian community, from the regime, all sorts of stuff. But for me, it's basically I ask for strength every time I get a letter. And I ask that all the letters be translated by me internationally, because I just seem to, a lot of them, I seem to understand their pain, and I just somehow can get through it. It's just basically I'm getting it from God. I can't explain it any other way. These letters are horrible, especially from Ayatollah Brujerdi or a couple of other people who have written. There's always a case that just devastates you, and many of us activists don't really sleep very much anymore. But it is a strength that comes to you from God. I really believe it. I don't know where else it's coming from. It's definitely not coming from me alone.
Yes, and this is the thing that I do with Cross in the Desert, Shadi. When I talk to many, many of the, my Iranian friends, I speak to them that there is a real hope and freedom in Christ. And with someone like a Saeed, he refuses to recant his Christian faith and return to Islam. This is the goal of their torturing him, that somehow he will break down and come back to Islam, but he refuses to leave Christ, Christ who has become his Savior, his strength, his everything.
Well, you have to realize that in Iran right now, it's an unbelievable number of Iranians who are converting to Christianity. And this is a big threat to the Islamic Republic, being the Islamic Republic. But I'm afraid that the Islamic Republic hasn't done a lot of good advertising for itself. So people are turning away from it. And what's interesting is that I wondered why are the Baha'is and the Christians are such a threat to them. And mostly because they're both religions of peace. The Baha'i faith is quite a beautiful faith. And Christianity, of course, they're all about forgiveness. And I think these people are so dark, they have turned their back on God, and they cannot tolerate the light. They can't tolerate it. They just need, somehow they need to perpetuate the darkness. I don't quite understand it, but that's what it is. Why are they so threatened by anyone who converts to Christianity of all religions?
Well, you mentioned the beauty of Christianity, and the number one thing that Jesus taught his followers under the most harshest and cruelest of conditions is to forgive your enemies, pray for them that persecute you. This is something unthinkable for Muslims that are extremists, to forgive, to show love, to treat your enemies right.
Yeah, it can't be done. It's not practiced. I mean, I think the Quran itself talks about God is all forgiving. I think if you read it, every section ends with the all forgiving, all merciful Allah. But I don't know how it doesn't go into practice because of maybe human nature. I'm not sure. The thing is, it's for example, under Islamic law, which Iran and many other countries like Saudi Arabia and Sudan and as such and many more are under, if someone steals something, doesn't matter what they stole for, the first time they're caught, four fingers are amputated. In Iran right now, It is actually dubbed Chop Chop Square. People are, their fingers come off. The second time they steal, their right hand comes off. The third time, their left foot comes off. This is actually in Islamic law. Why you wanted the right hand and the left foot? The reason is that, why is it so specific? So that the person has a very difficult time even walking with crutches. So the punishment is to be lifelong. Now, we did a call myself, Ms. Shabnam Asadullahi, and Nazain Afshinjam, and Mina Ahadi. We had done a call to halt the stoning of this couple in Iran. They're still stoning people, and nobody has responded to it at all. They're still stoning people for adultery. You commit adultery, even if your partner forgives you, your husband or your wife forgives you, they will execute you. If you're homosexual, you're executed. The penal code is right there. I have written an article on the penal code of the Islamic Republic, and it is horrifying. Absolutely anything and everything basically can get you killed as enemy of God. My father was actually, you know, his crime was enemy of God and a corrupter on earth. That's what he was killed for. That was his crime. And that's, anybody can be called that. My uncle was an enemy of God. Many of these people who are getting killed, it's called Muharreb, and it's enemy of God. So how do you explain such a thing? How do you explain that? And the clergy, you have to understand, there is no court. The court are clergy. The judge is clergy. There is no jury. All the trials in Iran are not legal under international law because there's no evidence. Nobody's allowed a lawyer. Many people, I think one of the lawyers of one of the Christians, actually, Mr. Nader Khani, his lawyer, is still suffering in prison. They released him, but the lawyer is in prison. So these are all kinds of stuff. Nasrin Sotoudeh, she was a lawyer. Mm-hmm. So even if you're a lawyer, unless you're a criminal lawyer for criminals, you're okay. But if you're a lawyer, if you're a woman's rights advocate, children's rights advocate, if you're a blogger, many bloggers right now are in prison. You can't actually do anything in Iran. The most famous is Sattar Beheshti, who died actually last November 6th. He was a blogger who had insulted the supreme leader, blah, blah, blah. Who knows? They're all nonsense anyway. But he died under torture. And he sent a letter out to human rights activists. So this is happening constantly, every day. It's getting worse. And I'm afraid with President Obama even having talks with him, it's given them more strength to carry on because they have tasted impunity once again. So whereas Canada stands firm, Canada is not at all interested. They are standing very firm on this regime, and they're being very cautious. So we're very proud of the Canadian government for that.
Yes, John Baird had a great article today about standing with the oppressed people, and I read it on the air before you came on. And again, Canada has implemented a special day of recognition for the 1988 massacre, the mass political massacre. Canada has been a wonderful, compassionate nation.
Well, the conservative government of Canada, the liberals would have never done such a thing.
Okay.
The liberals would have never done such a thing. It's the conservative government of Canada who has seen this. Under the liberals, this would have been absolutely impossible. So we are very fortunate that at this time we were under the conservatives.
Well, Shadi, what can you tell our listeners that are hearing this information, that are moved emotionally, they feel like they want to do something to make a difference, as you have done so well in your career as being an activist? What can you tell our listeners?
What can they do, you mean, to help?
Yes, yes.
Well, a lot of things go with petitions, all the petitions that are there. We have just done a petition to stop executions in the Islamic Republic. If you Google my name and the word petition, it'll come right up. And I also can send it to you later. You can put it on your blog if you want the link, and people can sign it. We did that because the activists in Iran asked us how sweet they were. They asked us to do a petition, which has never been done, to stop the executions in Iran. And they asked us with such broken English. It was adorable. We think it will work us. That's what they said. It was so cute, and we had to do it. And whatever they ask us, we'll do. The activists in Iran you know, we do it. So hopefully just many people will sign that. Signing petitions are important, and most important is taking the small little bit of time that you have, instead of watching TV perhaps or having
yes.
a cigarette break, write your, for you guys, your member of Congress, your politicians, just write them. And it's more important for non-Iranians to write, because they're so, they think we have an agenda, we are all traumatized, et cetera, et cetera. So it can't always be the activists that write them. It's nice if everyone writes them, especially for, you know, Saeed and Amir Hikmati. People should just remind President Obama's administration, what are you doing about it? What are you doing about it? And it's very easy to create a petition. Anyone can create a petition. You know, on online, it's for free. There's many things you can do. And you can also donate, because all of us, we do this for no money. We don't make any money from this, most of us activists. But there are organizations, for example, the Bermound Foundation, who has documented every single execution and torture since the beginning of the 79 one. The donations are good for them, because they need money to actually work all day on that. There is a campaign to free political prisoners, or CFPPI, which is in England. So there's quite a few organizations that Iran Human Rights Documentation Center. So even a donation of $5, which is nothing, really helps so that people can do
great.
Their work.
It's great, because we can all have a part to play. We can be a voice for the voiceless, Shadi. And I want to mention in passing that the lady that called you for my program today, her name is Kel. She is Canadian. She is my wonderful producer, and she
wonderful.
Has a program that talks about Islam, and she also has a heart for Iran. So you're in good company today with all of us here.
That's beautiful. I'm really glad about that.
I'm thinking of something to end everything. It's very hard to do, because you – I've so articulated so well the problems in Iran. You've articulated so well the history, how it came to be the way that it is, and how we can become involved. In these last couple of minutes, what can you tell us as listeners? What you want to share? Do you have a hope for your country of one day being a free Iran? What would be the last things you'd like to tell us today?
Well, I definitely have hope. There's always hope, because I do believe in there is a God, and I do believe, just like Anne Frank said, despite of everything, I believe people are good at heart. I really do. And I also want people to realize, all these people that I read about, the torturers, the interrogators, I also look at them, I feel sorry for them too, because nobody grows up and says, you know what I'm going to be when I grow up, a torturer, I want to be an interrogator. These people are also victims. Are they truly evil? I don't know. Something somewhere made them that way. So we have to pray for them too, and I often pray for them or ask them when I have shows or letters to come to our side and come to the light. Because we can't hate them. I don't hate them. I don't hate Rouhani. I don't hate any of them. I just want them to stop and come to the light, come to see what they're doing is horrible. So what we need to do is basically look at everything with a huge, huge thing of forgiveness and hope, because without forgiveness, there is no hope. And if the Iran regime changes tomorrow, we cannot have any more bloodshed. We can only achieve democracy and peace with forgiveness of all those who have betrayed everything. They have to go on trial, many of them, for crimes against humanity, but in a very fair way. There can't be any revenge or anything. And I just want Iran to go back to what I remember it. So when I have a hard time with what it is today, I close my eyes and remember running through the peach blossoms with my brothers and going around and having saffron-scented rice and tea, and how kind people were. Iran was not what it is today. I do not know who made these people, but they did not exist. Everybody was kind, caring, and educated, and concerned about their neighbor and their friends. So this was created by the Islamic Republic. They made people this way, and I want people to realize it can go back to the way it was, because goodness always wins over evil. It always has.
You're right.
The Nazis yes. have fallen. Even if communism fell, nobody can stay in power absolutely for that. So I think that the more we try to look at everybody who is doing these things and who's perpetrating all this, and truly, not just say it, truly forgive them, that is how you can shed light on the situation, and the situation can get better. That's just the way I do it. And I'm hoping that everyone does that. And we can't hate anyone who is doing any of this stuff.
You hit upon a key word, Shadi, forgiveness, because that's what Christianity is all about. We have broken God's law in our heart, and God in his arms of love and mercy forgives us in Christ. And that's what makes the difference in the world, Shadi. It has been an absolute pleasure. I have learned so much. I'm just so thankful you took an hour of your time out to educate us, to tell us what's going on.
Thank you so much for this opportunity. It's fantastic. I'm just grateful to everyone who's listening that they've taken their time to think about the people in Iran who cannot even speak for themselves. But I also want to remind people there are many countries like that, Sudan for being for once Saudi Arabia. There are many countries. So, I'm only doing the Iranian side of it because that's the language I know and that's my area of expertise. But we need to pray for all of them, for everyone. Syria, everyone, we have to. I cannot emphasize this enough. We can only do our activities, our activism, with pure heart and pure forgiveness of the people who are doing the evil to us.
I like that. You're absolutely right, because when we extend that mercy and grace and forgiveness, that's what it's all about. We criticize the wrongdoings and the evil, but we keep humble because we need to know that we are a forgiving people, and the only way to true peace is forgiveness and reconciliation, and I like your emphasis on that. God bless you, dear Shadi. You've been such a tremendous
asset. You too, and to your listeners too. Thank you so much.
Have a great day, and thank you for being on the cross in the desert. I don't know about you, but I am just, I'm almost speechless. I've spent an hour listening to a passionate, loving lady who dedicates her life to the freedom, to the hope of Iranians. And in so many ways, that's who I am. And I want to tell you, Shadi has been such a tremendous blessing to this program. She is such a wonderful representative of Canada, and I think within the next month I'm going to have her dear friend Shabnam on, who has a great story to tell as well. And so on the cross in the desert, we try to bring guests that will inform and educate you here. And thank you so much again, Shadi. You are a blessing, a true human being, and thank you for being on the cross in the desert. I can't think of any better song to segue into our last segment than this song by Matt Redman about grace. We're going to hear it right now on the cross in the desert.
There in the light of every sunrise, there in the shadows of this life, your great grace. It's there on the mountain top, there in the every day and the mundane, there in the sorrow. Such grace. Yeah.
That is the latest from Matt Redman on the cross in the desert. As I try to do on every program here on the cross in the desert, I try to get my wonderful producer, Kel Fritzy, into the program with me to give me her thoughts, feelings, and opinions about our subject when we talk about Iran. And I can think right now this is the best time to ask Kel Fritz to come on air with me, and let's talk about what we just listened to for the last hour. So, Kel, you want to come on and join me?
I am right here.
Have you ever heard anything
first of all,
like that before?
Let me say that I am in total awe of Sharipada. She was wonderful, and I'm probably not pronunciating her name properly, but I know she'll forgive me because she's Canadian, eh?
Yeah, there you go. She's your sister in Canada.
I cannot say enough about this beautiful, beautiful lady and coming out of Iran and dealing with what she had to deal with. And I was in the green room at one point, but I missed. She mentioned that she was around 13 in 1979. Am I correct in saying that, when the Iranian Revolution so-called came about?
She said she was 13, I believe, around that time, 13 years old. She was a teenager.
You know what? I was about her age as well.
Mm-hmm.
You see, you listen to people like Shadi, and they convey this material. She was 13 years old and living this, and finding her Persia being succumbed to the Iranian Revolution underneath the Ayatollah Khomeini. And we in the West, we take so much for granted, in that when I was 13, my biggest concern was which album am I going to buy for my pop and chip party on a Friday night.
Exactly. Exactly. What was I doing at 13?
She humbles me. This lady humbles me.
Yes.
I
didn't
think
know
it
she...
was... No, I had no idea about the breadth and the depth that this lady was living. And I'll tell you, Randy, when I do these shows on the Red Fox Blogger, I become more and more enlightened and educated. I really do have a true love for the peoples of Iran, and I'm so grateful, Randy, that you're doing this program.
Well, I when I was listening to Shadi, she says the very things that I feel, the forgiveness, the mercy. As an activist, she is not out to try to destroy people's life. She's trying to breathe new life into their wounds and their scars through speaking out for them, for extending forgiveness even to the very people that are torturing them. That's what Jesus taught. This is exactly what Jesus tells us to do. Because God is the ultimate judge. He will take care of all of these problems at the end of time. But we are not to be consumed and become like them. We're to be different. We're to be peacemakers. We're to be them who forgive. You see, this kind of evil can't exist in the light. Shadi said, coming to the light. So very true. Jesus says, I am the light of the world. So when we come to Christ, our hearts, our minds, our beings are transformed. Even the worst evil person in the world, God extends his love and grace to. And I was so touched by her humbleness about how she talks about forgiveness. Because I can imagine, when I read these stories about what happens, for instance, this 3-year-old girl in Saudi Arabia, gang-raped by Muslim men. I read that and I was so broken that anyone could stoop to such a level to commit such an act. And yet Shadi says, don't become like them, be peaceful, be forgiving.
Mm-hmm.
She's not just a human rights activist, she's a wonderful lady as well. I want to bring to our audience a clip right now. This is the story of Fatima's journey to the light, as we've been talking a little bit about today, how she found peace, not in Islam, not in any religion, but she found peace in finding Christ. And this is the story of Fatima, a Muslim Iranian lady, looking for peace. I want you to listen. On the cross in the desert.
Of the 7 billion people living on our planet, 2 billion are Christian and 2.1 billion are Muslim. Two different religions with two very different points of view. Fatima Divanbegi learned the truth about each of these religions in her search for a genuine relationship with God.
On the inside, I felt like there was a huge rock hanging in my heart. I could feel it. I could even tell you what it looked like. I mean, what the size of it was, what it looked like. It was real, and it was painful. It was like something that would draw me down and wouldn't let me, you know, live. There was no hope in it. There was no hope for the future.
Fatima was raised in Iran as a Muslim.
Being a Muslim is not by choice. It's by heredity. So if your parents were Muslims and you're born in that family, you're automatically a Muslim.
But Fatima resisted her parents' Muslim faith.
At a very young age, I started questioning existence, questioning whether there was a God or not. I would be like spending hours and hours and hours thinking about what would God look like? What would he, you know, where would he be? But traditionally in Islamic culture, you don't ask these questions. They're tabooed. You don't, if you start asking questions like these, they will call you faithless.
Growing up, the God of the Quran was the only God that Fatima ever knew.
He's not a personal God. He's distant and he's a creator. Nobody knows who he is. Nobody knows his nature. Nobody knows his plans. You just know that he cares about morality. And, you know, in order to go to heaven, you must do good works. So it's through your good works.
As a teenager, Fatima looked for answers in fortune-telling and by reading coffee grounds.
I did that for a few years. Like I said, I was still searching for God. That practice did not lead me to know God. But still I searched. I had no choice. Something in me would not rest. And finally I came to a conclusion. I said, God, you're either so complicated that I could never know you, or you're just right in front of my eyes and I can't see you. And so I remember, like, every day I would cry and cry and ask God to show me himself. I'd look at the sun. Are you the sun? Is that, you know, is that how you reveal yourself, you know? Where am I supposed to look?
Her cry was answered when Fatima says that Jesus appeared to her in a dream.
I dreamt that Jesus and I were walking in a rose garden. It's going to make me cry. And we were walking, and in the dream, I'm thinking he's a prophet. He's walking, and I'm just following, and he said, do you want to come with me? And I said, yes. And I said, and he said, then follow me. And I said, my mind thinking, how would you follow a person who's not even, I mean, he's a prophet a long time ago. How would you follow a person and not his instructions? You know, would you follow? So that was kind of puzzling. Why would he ask me that?
Night after night, Fatima had dreams about Jesus, God, and churches.
Old churches, new churches, modern churches, you know. And I dreamt that, you know, my mom and my home, well, our family are, you know, holding hands and going to the church.
Fatima moved to the United States when she was 20. She met a friend from work who told her about Jesus.
It was after he accepted the Lord Jesus that he found joy and peace. And those words just popped. And I said, wow, this is good. And he said, every time he receives it, every time they pray for him, he is filled with joy and peace. And I said, oh, I want that. I want the joy and peace, you know.
So Fatima went to a Christian church, and a woman there asked her,
do you believe Jesus Christ is God? And I said, did he say that? Did he say that, that he was God? And she said, yes, he says that. I said, sure, I believe he's good. Trust me, I'll find out if he's not. I didn't think of, you know, I'll just find out, you know, things aren't true. But I'm willing to give Jesus a try, like, definitely. And she said, do you want to pray, salvation prayer? Absolutely. So it was very, because of my, I think God had softened me up to the point that, you know, I was soft toward God, and I wasn't, you know, resistant.
That night, after years of searching, Fatima prayed to become a Christian.
Things just started changing. that heavy, heavy heart, that stone that I could, you know, it was sharp even, to feel how sharp and painful it was, that was gone. It was completely gone. That night, the Lord just he took his hand in my heart and took that rock out permanently. The one significant thing that God did for me, that Christ did, was that he put hope in my heart, a permanent hope. And as I got to know the Lord more, you know, of course, the Lord gave me many more dreams just to show that the scriptures were true and everything I was reading, God was backing them up.
Today, Fatima's mother, brother, and two sisters are all Christians. Fatima's a real estate broker and studying to be a psychologist. She's also married and has two sons. Fatima understands Muslims who are curious about Jesus and those who really don't understand who Jesus is.
I would say don't say no just because your parents were Muslims, parents before, you know, your great-grandparents were Muslims, and this is what you're always taught. You need to find God for yourself. He's available. You know, if Jesus says he's God, then he will prove it. All you have to have is an open heart to allow Jesus to come in, and then you will know for yourself if he's God or he's not God.
An amazing testimony from an Iranian Muslim woman who found Christ, who found peace. Now, you might be asking the question, she found peace, she found hope, because, yes, the Bible says that Jesus says, I've come to bring you life and life more abundantly, a rich and satisfying life. But wait a minute, Randy. This whole program you've talked about, Christians, like Fatima, who found that peace and hope, but their life is in constant turmoil and in danger. What's going on here? Jesus promises that rich and satisfying life, that abundant life. He is the peace that we are looking for, that is for sure. But there's also another reality. You see, just like Jesus was persecuted, we too will be persecuted. Just like he was hated, we also will be hated. We bear the scars. We bear the marks. Just like our Savior. We're not exempt from that. But God has a purpose in the evil. You see, this is the stumbling block for many, many Christians. God is all good. God is all powerful. There is evil. Where is God? Well, God is in control, sovereign control of the evil. He is greater and more powerful than any evil force arrayed against us. But it's in that evil that God brings out good. This is the book I'm about to finish writing called Beauty from the Ashes, The Promise Fulfilled. Beauty from the Ashes is another way of saying that God, in his divine wisdom, brings good out of the evil that we suffer with. We are like the beauty out of the ashes of suffering. You see, my sequel to The Promise is called Beauty from the Ashes. It's the story of Hannah and Rachel, who suffered through the Holocaust and 40 years later meet again in New York. And Hannah shares with Rachel, who was not a Christian, how God brought beauty out of her suffering. There is a beauty that God brings out of our suffering, because Jesus said we are going to stand before kings and governors and give our testimony. They're going to be hostile to us. They hate the truth. They hate the light. They hate the goodness. But our purpose in this world is to stand and make a witness for Jesus, and sometimes it can cost us our life. Jesus says to us, be willing every day to take up the cross. Follow me. You're not the Lord of your life. I am. And in that process of bearing testimony, bearing witness of who I am, there will be those that hate you and kill you, but understand the source. It's because they hate me, Jesus says. And because light and darkness are colliding. And so when I think of what Fatima said, I completely agree. She has found that peace. But in this world, we're going to have tribulation. Jesus says here in Luke chapter 21,
You will be dragged into synagogues and prisons, and you will stand trial before kings and governors because you are my followers. I think of the Iranian Christian prisoners, dragged into prison, being persecuted. But in this prison, they have the greatest opportunity to shine the light of Christ. I think of Miriam and Marzeah, captive in Iran, how God used them in such an incredible way in their captivity. I think about Saeed. I remember what Negma said at the Liberty Convocation just this past summer. 30 Muslims have given their heart to Jesus because of Saeed's testimony. And when he was dragged out of this prison and transferred, many of them were sad because they were saying goodbye to him, and they thought of him as a pastor. Jesus says, you're going to be going to prison. You're going to testify about me, but this will be your opportunity to tell them. You see, sometimes God takes us in the places in the world that we don't like, we're resistant to, but he takes us there to testify of him, to proclaim the gospel to those people that we would never ordinarily meet. Now, I know that sounds like, okay, so that's a reason why this suffering is happening, but it's still not easy. And no, it's not. No, it is not easy. Jesus tells us in this context in Luke chapter 21, verse 14, so don't worry in advance about how to answer the charges against you, for I will give you the right words and such wisdom that none of your opponents will be able to reply or refute you. I think of the Iranian Christians. The interrogators, the torturers, don't have an answer for what they claim. They want that same peace, but they're afraid. To leave Islam means their death, because Muhammad taught, if any man changes religion, kill him. It's a hadith quote. Jesus promised we are going to be dragged into prisons, but he will give us the words to speak. They won't be able to refute you. Then he says something that we're not expecting. Verse 16, even those closest to you, your parents, brothers, and relatives, and friends, will betray you. They will even kill some of you. Can you think of a time as a Christian when your own family wanted to kill you? They didn't understand. They were opposed to the message. Religious tradition captivates the mind in such a way that when you tell them I'm a Christian, they want to kill you. How dare you leave the traditions of what we believe? Jesus warned us that would happen. But then he says this, and this helps us to understand the evil of some people. And everyone will hate you because you are my followers. But not a hair of your head will perish. By standing firm, you will win souls. I'm thinking of my friends in Iran. I'm thinking of my one particular friend on Facebook, Ebi. I remember a time when he was off of Facebook for a while, and I was concerned about him. When he came back, he told me why he had been off. He had been lashed 70 times. Why? Professing Christ. And he was back again, and he shared that experience with me. You see, this is what Jesus says. They will hate you because you belong to me. One sure way of knowing that we are truly following Jesus is the hatred we receive, the persecution we receive because we speak of him. So the world hates Christ. Well, wait a minute. I thought Jesus, this master teacher full of peace and wisdom and forgiveness, why would they hate that? What was it about Jesus they hated? Well, here it is. He claimed to be Yahweh. He claimed to be God. And the religious leaders of the world would not tolerate the idea that God could come to them in a human form. This is repugnant to Islam. It's repugnant to every religion of the world, that God himself came down to us in human form. You see, and the reason why is because the only way to fix the problem, the only way to bring reconciliation, the only way to bring salvation and forgiveness was to come and do it. You see, that's something you and I cannot do. We cannot earn our salvation in any way. If we try to live up to the merits of the law, we would have to live them perfectly from day to night, from beginning to end, from cradle to grave. No one does that.
But that's God's high, lofty, holy law. No one can win salvation by keeping the law. The law shows us our sinfulness, and the law reveals sin, and the law tells us we need a Savior. That's the purpose of the law. So if you're like Fatima today, and you're searching for peace, you're searching for a rich and satisfying life, you can find that in following Jesus. You can find that in coming to Him. But I want you to understand something other than just that. You may be called to suffer just like many of my Iranian friends have for your faith. And now sometimes when people hear that, when they hear that that's part of the Christian walk, that's offensive, and they walk away. But we have to lay out the whole scenario. You find peace. You find happiness and a rich and satisfying life. You find forgiveness of all of your sins. And it could cost you your life for being a follower of Jesus. That's part of the call to salvation that we have to understand. I got a couple of minutes left, and I want to tell you today so much how much I appreciate your time and attention to this program, to spending the time and learning about Iran. Today has been an incredible program with Shadi Pavey, who has given us a history of Iran, her personal involvement, her human rights activism, and she shared with us how we too can get involved in being a voice for the voiceless. I want to remind you again, please sign the petition for my brother Saeed at BeHeardProject.com. This is something so important. I believe as we continue to pray and continue to speak out and continue to petition, I believe this will put pressure enough on the Iranian government. They will listen to us. They did so in the case of Pastor Youssef a couple of years ago. They did so in the case of Mary and Marzea. They will listen to pressure and petition. Let's keep praying and let's keep speaking out. This is so important for you and me. I want to thank my dear behind-the-scenes producer, Kel Fritzi, for her time, for her commitment to this program, because it wouldn't happen without her, and I sincerely mean that from the heart. And I want to thank you, the listener, for listening to this program today. My name is Randy Noble. God bless you. I will see you on the next Cross in the Desert. A month from now, we're going to have Shabnam, and she's going to tell us all about her activism as an Iranian human rights activist as well. God bless you. Have an incredible day. Darkness you shine, out of the ashes we rise.